Welcome to Moving the Needle in Medicine, a monthly podcast from HCP Live, where we talk with physicians and leaders whose work is changing the field of medicine. Our goal is to gain insights about the motivations that got them there and what drives them to do what they do. I'm your host, Alexander Hajduchuk. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, through the HCP Live cardiology platform, and on YouTube. Today's guest brings a perspective that starts far outside of academic medicine. Growing up in a rural farming community, and it evolves into a career at the forefront of heart failure, transplant medicine, and clinical research. But what makes his story particularly compelling is not just what he's built, but what has driven him to build it. Please welcome Dr. Andrew Sauer. So I'll start from the beginning of, you know, growing up. How did you basically, what led to get to you to this point? Were there any specific inflection points early in your career? I'll kind of let you take a stab at, just giving me the whole history of your life.
It's like the interview question. Tell me about yourself, right?
Exactly. And basically, this is just a med school interview a couple years later.
Yeah, well, I think origin stories are important. I think if you want to put, you know, a particular perspective in context, it always helps to know how one started. But the short version of the story is I grew up in small town Nebraska, my extended family in Iowa. Basically, I was raised by farmers, teachers, and military veterans. And then my dad climbed poles for a public utilities company. So I grew up moving around a lot. And I say that's relevant because I learned early on as really a young boy that, you have to adapt to the things that happen in life. You know, my dad was working through his way up promotions, you know, sort of in a blue collar job, climbing poles and public utilities meant that every year we were changing schools and changing towns and changing houses. And so resilience was something that became just part of my DNA, I would say, from the standpoint of learning how to adapt to changing environments. I also think that I picked up work ethic early on in life, you know, had a lot of the world's worst jobs out there, from detasseling to mowing lawns to, you know, cleaning up baseball diamonds in the public sphere and mowing cemeteries and waiting tables and all those things. But, you know, you realize when you go through discomfort and overcome challenges at an early stage that there's a lot you can take on. And I think going down the medical pathway is one where you're going to encounter a lot of barriers, and resilience is super key. And sometimes I get a little concerned about, you know, when I look at my own kids, you know, how much are we exposing our kids and younger generation to challenges to allow them to develop that thickened skin that you need to kind of go through the trenches that we go through. But the other part of my origin story is my grandfather, who was a veteran of Korea and, you know, served also during the Vietnam era. He had mental health issues and led him to be honorably discharged, but this left him in a state where he had a lot of the cardiometabolic disease that I treat today. He had diabetes. He had advanced complications of diabetes. He had bladder cancer, lung cancer. He was a smoker till the day he died, and he actually died of sudden cardiac arrest in my grandfather's in his own living room. And I was 11, and it had a very impact on my life. And I think what had an impact was also just the lack of diligent care that he received at the time. I remember feeling, even as a young person, that my grandfather was dismissed by the medical society in particular. And it really drew me to medicine because I felt like, you know, if I was going to dive into something, I wanted to make a difference in the way that I felt like my grandfather needed, and I couldn't give him that care when I was just a child, obviously. But I've also seen that extend to many family members that I've had over the years who've suffered from heart disease or cardiometabolic disease, and it set me on a path. But as we both went to the same med school, so I then moved off to Rochester. Spent a couple good years there. Art Moss was my first cardiovascular mentor. He's a legendary figure in the electrophysiology space. And I thought I was going to be an electrophysiologist. Spent some time in the ICU at Mass General for my residency under people like Jim Januzzi, Jag Singh, some other folks who really were instrumental in forming my early career as a resident. And then I realized that I wanted to be part of the mechanical revolution. And that wasn't happening in Boston at the time. So this was 2010-ish, 2009, 2010, when I left Boston. And, you know, the rise of the durable LVAD was going on very much in full in Chicago at that time. So I jumped in under a program that was just being built at Northwestern, you know, when Pat McCarthy and Ed McGee left Cleveland Clinic in 2004 to build that program. And so I got to train under those guys and the surgeons. I like to say I was trained by surgeons, which is, in my mind, one of the best ways to learn durable MCS, is when you learn from the folks that think about the surgical approach predominantly. And the last thing I'd say, as I was getting started in my career, is I experienced another form of adversity during the throes of my fellowship. So in my second year of fellowship, as they were recruiting me to become an advanced fellow, they needed me to start the year up because there wasn't anybody interested in this space. And back then, that was pretty common. And Northwestern was just getting started with the ACGME certification. So they had their first class when I started, which was 2012, as the first ACGME accredited advanced heart failure transplant fellow. But right as this was happening, three of the four attending cardiologists, transplant cardiologists, left at the same time. So I did my entire advanced fellowship year with one board certified, fully trained transplant cardiologist who was also a pretty junior doc at the time. But we had a lot of help. We had people like Clyde Yancey that were there at the time who were very seasoned in heart failure and transplant. And they, you know, they did a lot to mentor me. And I took my first faculty appointment right after that. And I was one of two more that we recruited. We ended up recruiting Alan Anderson and Jonathan Rich to come over from University of Chicago. And I was part of the four group, you know, my first year on faculty. But it was a baptism, if you will, in advanced heart failure, LVAD transplant. It was half the year was donor call and being basically on call all the time. But, you know, it prepared me for so many things that would come after, because I felt very comfortable with the clinical space, you know, between a Rochester Medical School, a Mass General residency training, and then a total beatdown in fellowship. You know, I was ready for whatever was going to come from a standpoint of patient care. And so it emboldened me to be willing to take on risks coming out of fellowship that I think a lot of folks would not feel as comfortable taking on, because I knew, you know, taking care of the patients was the part I was prepared to do. And it was the leadership learning curve that was the big challenge coming out of training.
So Ben, how do you think that, sounds like it helped more than it hurt, but maybe with some growing pains. And then how did that set you up for the next step?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great way to put it. You know, it helps more than it hurt, but we shouldn't dismiss the reality that those types of growing pains involve pain. And sometimes that pain is necessary and appropriate, and sometimes it can actually create a little bit of injury. And so I think there was probably a little bit of workplace injury associated with that, to nobody's fault. It's not like anybody wanted that situation to happen. And it was an enormous opportunity that I don't regret taking, and I would have never passed up. But it took its toll, you know, when you're basically, you know, and you can't even get away with this now, right? It's not even possible. But, you know, in those days, it was a little easier to understand that there wasn't an abundance of advanced heart failure transplant fellows out there. You know, now we still have a challenge filling those spots, but back then the fellowship didn't even exist. It was really brand new. So you pretty much had to recognize that if you were going to train in that era and you were going to be part of this revolution of durable MCS, temporary MCS, all of this stuff was really taking off, that meant you were going to drink from fire hose. But drinking from that fire hose can take its toll, because what we do is we watch a lot. We have a front row seat to suffering, right? That's what you have to prepare yourself for. And there really is no preparing for it. On the back end, though, outside of, you know, maybe I wish I would have had a little bit of time to sort of breathe and, you know, recover a little bit, because I jumped into my first faculty year also very much in the trenches. There were only four of us for this entire program that was growing. And, you know, so that meant we had two different inpatient services. And so it was the usual 26 weeks of rounding, you know, and I'm in my first year trying to build a research portfolio, trying to, you know, earn some grant funding. And, you know, you try to have 20% protected research time, but that's not really possible when you're rounding 26 weeks a year. Again, nobody really wanted it designed that way, but
yep.
It created a very big challenge, which is I had to have a bit of a crossroads where was I going to be able to pursue this academic track that I think a lot of us are taught to run after, the traditional kind of route, or was I going to carve a different path? And in November of 2014, I got a call to look at building our own program with my surgical colleague, Travis Abicht, who was also at Northwestern at the time, on faculty, and he'd essentially grown up and trained with me. And we got this call to go take a look at building our own program in Kansas. And at the time, it was totally crazy. I knew it was a crazy idea. But I also knew that Travis and I had worked together for several years. We could read each other. We knew how to work with each other. We had an understanding and an appreciation of each other's approach and style. We trusted each other. And we knew that if we came together, I wouldn't have to recruit a surgeon. He wouldn't have to recruit a cardiologist. We had each other. And that we could probably take this on because we felt prepared because we've been well-trained. It was pretty crazy, but I think the other thing that helped is we both had a bit of a chip on our shoulder. And you just need a little bit of that chip, that edge that says, you know, I shouldn't want to do this. This is crazy. And yet I still want to do it because people don't believe we can. And I think a lot of people did not believe that that was going to be possible for, I mean, at the time I was 33, he was 35. You know, we were a couple young pups, you know, nearly straight out of fellowship, and we were going to go build a program brand new, by the way, across the street from where I work today, which at the time was still doing almost 50 transplants a year. So, you know, it had its challenges, but I do believe that that training environment really allowed me to feel like it was worth taking a risk. And I would encourage people to think deeper about what you have the capacity to do. You have more capacity to do than you think you do. You just have to do that soul search and decide if you want to step out there. And by the way, you're going to step out there and accept the grenades, because people love to root for failure. That's the truth. I had to learn very early that it turns out there's a good chunk of people out there that want to see you succeed, but there's another big chunk of people out there that really don't want to see you succeed. And recognizing that they're going to throw the grenades and they're going to discourage you and they're going to tell you that this is dumb and they're going to tell you that this is crazy. But the reality is, if you do your soul search and say, what am I doing it for? And for me, it was for the people who ultimately you see behind me in those white shirts, you know, those first 10 transplants that we did that are still alive today. Those are the people that I knew I would be making a difference for, is that we would be providing a therapy that didn't exist for a state that did not have one. And, you know, people can say, well, there was a program in Oklahoma, there was a program in Nebraska, there was a program in Colorado, there's a program across the street in Kansas City, Missouri. But if you understand anything about transplant, you know that if a state does not have a program, there will be people left in the margins who will not get care. And we saw that left and right. And when we built both programs, we saw that this raised the bar for the whole region. Nebraska got more aggressive. St. Luke's got more aggressive. Integris got more aggressive. Colorado got more aggressive. I can point to the data from 2015 to 2020. All those programs grew. They actually grew despite our existence. That tells you that it's about making an impact, and that's what we're doing this for. And that's what matters to me, is my legacy. I don't really care as much about some of the details that other people care about. I care about looking back on my life and thinking I made a difference to a region, to a population, to individual patients at the bedside in a way that I couldn't make by just kind of doing the usual path that they tell you to take.
It's so interesting hearing this, because you and I have had this conversation probably many times, but you know, I learn more and more about you every time that we talk. And just listening to that, it almost seems like, you know, the foundation was laid back in, you know, your days of growing up, building resilience, not having things always go your way. And then it's almost kind of, it's repeated itself in several different facets of life, whether it be growing up and or for early jobs and making ends meet, or, you know, training and then, you know, first job out of training. And I think that you've really done a great job in one, obviously been successful in building these programs, but two, talking about it, because I don't think that that happens a lot. I think that a lot of this kind of goes into the ether. Some people know about it, maybe locally, but you've really done it on a national and international scale, you know, on the social media side of things. And, you know, I think that that's where a lot of impact can be done.
Yeah, I had to learn the social media language, I think, as part of the goal of trying to get people to be aware of what we're doing. It was very awkward at first. You know, I've got a lot of followers in both LinkedIn and Twitter now, and X, I should say, is what we're calling it now. But, you know, the reality is that was also a learned skill, because a lot of people, again, didn't want to hear about it. But I realized that I couldn't trust my own system to do the marketing for us. We had to do it ourselves. And again, you can't always trust that the system's going to hand you what you need. There's, you know, James Clear always talks about this. There are three reasons why things happen in your life, and only three. It's your luck, your randomness, which of course, you know, it is just what it is. You can't control that part. It's your choices or your strategy, and it's your actions or your habits, you know. The other way I like to think about it is you can choose your actions, you can choose your consequences, but you can't choose both. And I like to construct my life based on sort of defining what I believe the consequence should look like. I sort of think about, this is what I want to have happen. And, you know, chance favors the prepared. At the end of the day, if you're ready to go and you've got the habits baked in and you've already decided what you want the outcome to look like, and then you've developed your actions and your habits in line with that, then the opportunities that come aren't just totally random, are they? They start to actually look like providence. And that is, to me, like why I can look back at my life and say, it can look like I had this wandering career. In many ways, I did. I actually reinvented myself 3 years ago, and I left transplant VAD program leadership, and now I'm running a research program. You know, and I'm not in transplant LVAD program leadership. Now I'm doing a much more traditional academic kind of role, and I'm having a great time. But that wasn't random. You know, that was still strategic as the opportunities changed in front of me over the course of my career. So I think, you know, a lot of times people can look at us and say, they just don't seem like they're very organized, they're bouncing around, and then they're not paying attention to the fact that there's actually quite a bit of ordering going on and organization and strategy. But really it comes down to what we experience in life is a product of our daily choices, our daily habits, you know, which aren't even choices, by the way. That's what James Clear says. You know, that's not part of the choice hierarchy. The habits are things that you decide to program as part of your day because of the choices that you are making.
So you touched upon a little bit of kind of bouncing around in different niches and in different spheres. You know, I think when you and I first met, one of the reasons was, well, one, from social media, but two, in this remote monitoring space. Mm-hmm. And now, like you mentioned, you know, in parallel, you're doing transplant and VAD and now have moved on to cardiometabolic. Tell me about the remote monitoring space. What brought you to it initially? What excites you about it, and kind of how you've leveraged that into, you know, the newer stuff that you're doing?
Yeah, it's a very cool kind of way to think about history, you know, over one's career. I got into remote monitoring really because nobody was doing it in my region. And it's another example of sometimes you just choose to do the thing that nobody else is doing, and you go where the blue ocean is, you know, and we're sitting in this wide open space called Kansas. We're building this dedicated advanced heart failure program that had obviously the transplant volume that I cared about. We had the LVAD volume that I cared about, but I realized pretty quickly. So here we are, 2014, 2015, CardioMEMS had just been FDA approved after the CHAMPION trial, which of course was controversial at the time. And so it wasn't readily, it wasn't being readily adopted. For example, it hadn't been really adopted, hadn't been adopted at all when I was in Chicago. So while I was in Chicago, I hadn't even seen one other than in the Champion trial, which we had some patients floating around from that. So I looked around in the region and nobody was doing anything in remote monitoring at the time. I mean, we had this transplant program at St. Luke's across the street, but I didn't really see Nebraska or Oklahoma really just diving into this. And so I thought this is a great opportunity for us to get involved in both a clinical program build that synergizes with the heart failure program and allowed me to get my foot in the door on some clinical trials. And to truth story, I had to beg Abbott to let us be part of the GUIDE-HF study. And then when I finally got the leadership to meet with me, I won't name any names, but multiple members of the Abbott leadership, all of them have now moved on, so they're not there anymore. They did not believe that we were serious players. And so they did not want to give us access to the clinical trial, and they wanted us to kind of prove our ability to build a different kind of program. They kind of said, well, grow the VAD program a little bit bigger, and then we'll talk. But we basically were able to get them to come and take a meeting with them. And I made a very bold move. And I said, tell me how many patients I have to enroll for you to take us seriously. And the number they came back with, guess what the number was? 100 patients is what they said.
I was going to ask if it was 100. Seems like
I don't know where they came up with that number, but they said, you need to enroll 100 before and tell us that you think you can enroll 100 before we take you seriously, which is a crazy number for a clinical trial, any clinical trial. And I said, you know what? I think we can do that. I actually have no reason to believe that we can't, because I knew what was coming through our program. And I knew that we had basically complete access to the entire state. And we had a very aggressive outreach campaign. And at one point when we got, the other thing they needed us to do is get through startup within 90 days, which is not always so easy to do, but we pushed it through. And, you know, long story short, we ended up enrolling over 100 patients between the randomized and the single arm of GUIDE-HF. We were the highest total enroller in the study. Ended up getting to be a co-author on the Lancet paper for the original manuscript, you know, because of our enrollment is really the only reason that I was entitled to participate in co-authorship. And so it was a true example of just saying, you know, we want to do this. This is important for our strategy as our portfolio, as a team. We made it about the team. And at one point, we were enrolling 5 to 10 patients every month on a regular basis. And we made this about relying on more than just one person. So a lot of people helped with enrollment. We had multiple implanters that were not heart failure docs, by the way. So we learned how to make it a big tent, make it inclusive, make it something that everybody cared about. And it's something that if we can't be the best at everything, which we couldn't, right? We could be the best at maybe one thing. And that's kind of the way we phrased it, is like, this is going to be where we put our stake in the ground and we're going to get ourselves known for this. And the thing is, it worked. A lot of people paid attention. And to this day, Kansas City is a bit of a mecca now in both programs across the state line. And also, if you look at all the programs that started up around the region, next thing you know, there's a CardioMEMS program everywhere you turn around. And so this region actually has some of the highest volume of any place in the United States as a result of that osmosis. And I think it also gave me an opportunity to be seen outside of that particular study by other study leaders who said, hey, what are they doing over there? How are they enrolling like that? Who are these people? Who are the coordinators? And who are the investigators? And by the way, maybe we want to see if they want to get involved with us. So it was really the sort of one of the things that helped me make the crossroad transition into diving back into research as my main thing, you know, which happened a couple of years ago. And now I'm in a very different role, almost all because of some of that early momentum in those days.
Was this, you know, working with Abbott and CardioMEMS around this time, was this the first time that you were really working with a lot of device companies and industry, or did you have prior experience in that?
You know, I got involved with clinical trials right out of fellowship, but I'm not in a big way. Like, I was sort of just dabbling. And so if you look at my CV, or if you look at my PubMed and you look at my publication record, there was basically a desert of almost no papers between, you know, I kind of peaked in fellowship and the end of fellowship and maybe my first couple years on faculty, and then just dropped, you know, and there was like four papers written from the years like 2017 to 2020, you know, maybe 2019. So there was a couple years there where there was just nothing going on. And I was just kind of dabbling because I was focused on clinical program building. I mean, I was focused on building and certifying a brand new heart transplant program, you know, growing a brand new VAD program, building an ICU that we had to have to support ECMO and temporary MCS. And so there wasn't a lot of opportunity to get too involved with industry. But again, a lot of this work is synergistic. So then you're growing a clinical trials platform slowly as you're growing a big clinical infrastructure. You have a leadership role. You're growing your social media presence as you're trying to advertise and market your program and get people to notice. More and more opportunities start to come. And so Sanjeev Shah, one of my mentors at Northwestern, used to have this board in his office, and all it said was yes. And I remember thinking, I am a disciple of yes. At a stage coming out of training, you have to go through a few years, I think, where you're just saying yes. And you just, you know, make yourself available to people who want to bring you opportunities, and you just soak them up. At some point, you got to learn that the next word is no. And it's different for everybody when that time comes. But I do think that one of the best things for my career that accelerated me was this attitude of, you know what, if nobody else wants to do it, that's perfect for us. Because that created so many opportunities. You know, we took advantage of opportunities to build things for patients in the spaces that nobody wanted to go, geographical spaces or clinical spaces. And that has time and time again in my early career paid off in so many ways, because it allows you to take risk. It allows you to get recognized for that. And then you get more opportunities, especially if you can get members of the team that would grow and want to take that on with you. And by the way, it made it so much fun for the team. We started with just a few people, obviously. And at one point, our team grew to over 45 clinical team members across this heart failure group at the time that I left. And, you know, it just was a lot of fun because people wanted to build together. People like building things together. And I think that I liked leading building things together. And that's what I learned, that that's really what I'm about, you know, building things together to help not just individual patients, but populations of patients.
Yep. You mentioned mentorship along the way. Do you think, talk to me about that a little bit, you know, when was it important in an early stage? How has it been continually important as you progressed throughout your career?
Yeah, it's an obvious, it's so important. And I guess, what can I add to the conversation about mentors? And I think my points that I make that I think are additive are points that maybe people don't think about as often. So you absolutely have to have mentors. But what I tell people is you need lots of mentors. I think it's actually dangerous to go to one or two mentors for like all of your advice. And the thing I just learned very quickly is that I had to figure out, I go to this mentor when I want this particular niche content expertise. I'm not going to go to them for every other aspect of advice, you know, because they may not be aligned, for example, with me and my goals. Remember, I have to pick my own targets, my own strategy. What I need the mentor for is to help me figure out how to execute my strategy. So, for example, you know, there's one mentor that may be, you know, the best mentor for, you know, building your pathway to academic promotion. And they are really like crafted at like what it makes to, how do you define a triple threat, you know, academic cardiologist, that traditional pathway. They know exactly how to go down that path. Well, that's probably not the same mentor that's going to teach you how to build a brand new transplant program. Let me tell you, almost no way that the same person that knows how to climb the, you know, climb the academic promotion ladder, like, and knows that cold, there's almost no way that person is also the person that's going to tell you how to go after a CMS certification of a transplant program for the first time in history since the program collapsed 20 years before. I think the bottom line is pick your mentors who, A, are aligned with you and they're invested in you. Also be careful, because some mentors just like to hear themselves talk. about what they did and how they did it. The reality is, if you're coming to them, be mindful of what it is that you're trying to learn from them and how it relates to your goals. That's what defines mentoring. And so I believe you should have many, many mentors. I've got mentors in life who help me with financial decisions. I don't really trust many physicians to give me financial advice because honestly, physicians are pretty terrible at it. So be careful getting advice from many of our colleagues because I don't think that I am aligned with a lot of the ways that physicians organize their finances and organize financial strategy. So for me, like one of my goals is to be able to retire earlier, even if I don't. I just want to be able to. And I've had plenty of mentors who say, well, come on. Academic medicine, academic cardiology is the most privileged profession in the history of the world. Why wouldn't you want to work till you're dead? Dude, I don't want to. I don't have to explain it. I don't want to work till I'm dead doing this. I want to be able to pick my own goals and pick my own interests. And if I decide that I want to, you know, become a forest ranger, you know, maybe I want to do that. And you shouldn't judge that that's what I want to do. I'm asking you how to help create a pathway so that I can retire early. So what I learned is like, if I want to talk about early retirement, then I need to talk to people who are aligned with that strategy and have shown that they know how to do that. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but pick mentors that are aligned with you. You have to have multiple mentors over multiple content domains, and then be willing to listen to them. Pick mentors that will give you what you need, not what you want to hear. That'll tell you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear. Because if you just want to go to people and hear, you know, good job, pat on the back, well, that's not a mentor. I don't even know if that's a friend. It's definitely not a friend. So I think being willing to, you know, seek out mentorship and really, you know, as we say, this is teaching, you know, recognize when you're being taught something and accept it.
So I'm picking up on another theme here, and it seems like you've had a lot of success of basically going outside of your comfort zone. And, you know, everybody talks about how getting comfortable, being uncomfortable, and you've carved out certain niches in this. And a lot of this takes a lot of hard work and years of preparation and mastery, but there's a balance as you've alluded to. And I think that there's a lot of talk in the space about wellness, and prevention of burnout and work-life balance or integration, or, you know, pick your way of defining it. How do you define wellness, and how have you made this a point to be such a, like a big factor in your career and just how you do your day-to-day life?
Well, I think it's an evolution for me. I think I learned that wellness matters by having stages in my career where I wasn't well. And so I think the first step, if you want to have an honest, sincere conversation about wellness, is we have to acknowledge that as a profession, we do a pretty terrible job allowing people to not be okay. And so the first step is acknowledging that there are going to be seasons, there are going to be things that we see, that we experience in the course of doing our work, and it's workplace hazard, sometimes amplified by workplace hostility. These experiences are real, they exist. And the idea that we kind of, you know, indirectly or directly suppress the ability for physicians to come out and speak about their struggles is a real shame. Suicidality is one of the highest, we have some of the highest suicidality of any profession. We all know somebody who's been touched by severe mental illness and potentially suicide. And the reality is, one of the challenges that I'm ashamed of with our profession is that we still have surveys that come from our credentialing offices across the health systems that require us to report whether we've ever had a moment where we maybe couldn't really do our job because of a mental illness, or maybe a transitory struggle with substances or other challenges. And so we're basically being told to just be quiet about it? Because if you answer yes to that question, you're going to have somebody call you into some office and say, what's going on? I don't know if I can give you, you know, your privileges. It's really inappropriate. And so one of the first things I learned is I went through seasons where I really struggled. I went through seasons where, and I've been pretty public about this, where I was depressed. I went through seasons where I medicated with alcohol, with grandiosity, which is, I think, basically what we talk about with workaholism, you know, where I basically treated myself with, let's chase the next mountaintop, and then maybe I'll feel better, get some more dopamine from that social media post. I've been through all those forms of medication, and I found it to be very destructive and not helpful to my ability to actually be well. And it's an ongoing lesson, I would say. And I think we're all prone to different things. But the other thing I learned is that when you can look in the mirror and realize that you're not okay, what are you going to do about it? So I've gone to therapy off and on. I totally subscribe to that. I've been on and off meds. I haven't really found that meds help me, but I think if that's what helps, please do it. Seek help from a professional. The other thing is building in those habits, as we talked about at the beginning, that create the other forms of wellness that help you develop healthy resilience. I don't like using resilience as the strategy to deal with burnout because it's due to moral injury, which we're being exposed to. Sometimes the best thing you can do is get out of whatever environment you're in if it's toxic. And I don't think resilience is gonna help you when the environment is truly toxic. So assuming that you're just dealing with the routine hazards of, you know, the grind of seeing patients suffer and doing our best to work with them and overcome the suffering with those patients, I think that there's got to be a healthy routine of physical exercise, strength building, you know, putting time for yourself to get sanctuary, getting time alone with your thoughts, turning off all of the electronics. You know, I like to say you've got to build a couple different sanctuaries. I turn my office into a sanctuary. I've got my kids' artwork all around here. You know, why? Because it allows me to be in my little happy place in here. And even if I'm at work, I can kind of go into my zone. And I can also learn to carve out the time to allow me to use my creative energies and, you know, block other things out. So it takes a lot of intentionality in terms of the discipline of managing your calendar and not letting people overrun. And that's where the whole stage of life where you have to start saying no comes in as part of that strategy for wellness. So in summary, be willing to talk about not being well. Call it when you see it. Be willing to acknowledge that you need help. Be willing to pay attention to those signals when you're medicating a problem, when you should actually be treating the problem and addressing and rooting out the problem. And then build those healthy diet of the things that we know help program, you know, true wellness as part of our daily discipline, which I think the biggest issue is physicians are so good at sacrificing all the time, sacrificing themselves for everybody else. And I have said this, you know, true self-care is the opposite of selfish. And it's the best way that you can be a better parent, a better husband, a better son or daughter. It's the best way for you to be the best cardiologist, best physician you can, is for you to, you know, really try to make sure you're taking care of yourself every day. Maybe even as the first thing of the day, I'd argue, is, you know, really not selfishly, but focused on taking care of yourself, because you can't take care of anybody else if you're a mess, you know, inside. And the truth is, we got a lot of reasons to have messy stuff inside.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a phenomenal perspective. Not enough people are talking about these things, and just the way that you phrased it, you know, for people to not shy away from talking about mental health or their own struggles. You know, I think that you've been a pioneer kind of to be vulnerable. And I think that takes a lot. And, you know, I've learned so much from you. I know a lot of our friends and colleagues, you know, look up to you from that standpoint, because it's super impressive. It's super difficult to say, hey, I'm struggling, and, you know, then figure out what to do from there. I think the other thing is, you know, I've known you pretty well on a personal level for the last couple of years. And, you know, you make a very strong effort to to do a lot of family time and trips. And how do you balance that? And basically, what are the things that like really would that you love to do the most on your free time?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this comes down to realizing at some point, again, I feel very inclined toward thinking a lot about legacy. And I've had enough mountaintop experiences in my career to make me stop as I'm at the top of the mountain and look around and say, you know, what's the next mountain? And have that answer become, you know what, at this point, honestly, I just want to make sure that when I'm at the end of my life, that my kids were part of what I was chasing on the next mountain. You know, I don't want to miss out on the most important legacy that's ever going to exist related to me, which is that I'm the only father that those three kids have. And it just has become ever more impressed upon me that there are these little humans who, you know, they only have one dad. And if I'm gone, they'll never have another dad. And so, whether I'm gone because I've died, or I'm gone because I'm on a trip, or I'm gone because I'm preoccupied in my office, or I'm preoccupied with the EMR at 8 o'clock at night on my laptop on the dining room table, there's a consequence to being absent, you know, from these little humans in my life. And so I've realized, and I think I've just been fortunate that I've had enough success in my career that I don't have a big itch to scratch anymore. And so it's allowed me to rethink, you know, what really matters. And when I fell in December and busted my kneecap and I was basically temporarily disabled, it just put this really front and center for me even more, where I just realized, you know, I just went from being a normal functional person to being somebody who's experiencing disability for the first time. And I was meeting with my surgeons, and they were telling me things like, I might not be able to hike or ski again. And I'm thinking about it not so much from the standpoint of what I don't get to do, but what I don't get to do with my kids. I take them skiing. I now can't do that anymore. I can't go on these hikes in the mountains with them. And so I realized I got to get that back. I got to fight for that. And to do that, I need to literally move as many mountains in my way so that I can be there for these moments, because they're so fleeting. And I think that's true, whatever your family structure is, you know, whoever it is that is part of your legacy that you need to leave behind, because we are all going to be forgotten the moment we leave our employers. You know, we will be forgotten. Look at that movie about Schmidt, and it's so true. You know, you move on and you think everybody's going to remember everything you did, and the truth is, you don't mean as much to your employer as you think that you should. But you know who you do have a lot of you should worry about is when your kids don't have you around, and they don't have anybody else, you know, that could fill in that role. So that's the number one job, is what I've realized. Took me a long time to learn that, and I haven't learned it fully. It's a process, but I do think that we have to stop and remember it's a job. It's an important job. It's a calling in many ways, but someone else can do that job. No one else can be the father to my kids. And so that's why I think I'm at that stage where I think a lot about that as I think about how I construct my work. You know, it allows me to think about creative ways to say, how do I get my time back? That's why I talk a lot about the number one thing you can do with your money is turn it into time. That's true wealth, because then you can turn that time into time with the people you love. And I've tried to be a lot more intentional about that at this stage.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is all great advice, and more of us should certainly listen to it. And it's tough. I mean, time is, you know, your number one currency, and it's scarce. Are there anything, you know, speaking from a productivity standpoint, you know, when you're constructing your day to day, I think a long time ago, you and I talked about this green zone for getting work done. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you know, implement that into your just day-to-day workflow?
Yeah, it's basically a disciplined approach to managing your time. And I'm blanking on the book that references and explains this. I don't have it up on my bookshelf here. But basically, the idea is that all of us have a couple hours where our brains are like really ready to go with creative juices and we're like at our peak. It's not the same for everybody. For me, it's from the hours of about 9 to 11 in the morning. You know, I've even compressed it a bit. I used to think it was about 3 hours. I think for me, I'm like at my sharpest creative energy between 9 and 11. And so what I'll try to do is organize my day. And I am very, very obsessive over my calendar and the control of my calendar. And I do have an administrative assistant who helps me with my calendar, but I will put blocks and holds all across my calendar. And if I can't get the 9 to 11 window, that's fine. But what I will do is I'll block 2-3 hours on enough days in the week, and I will not let those slots get violated with meetings because, you know, on the weeks that I'm not in rounding, you know, of course, because that's impossible. But on weeks where there is an opportunity, putting those down, because if you can then take advantage of those blocks and turn everything else off. So that's not the time to answer emails. That's not the time to have your phone on, you know, turn the ringer off, let people know that please don't call me within this block. You know, if it's like, you know, some family members or something, let them know in advance, put it on their calendar too. And then you just go and do your creative energy work, because so that's when I do my writing. That's when I build my slides. That's when I do my dreaming. Honestly, sometimes I'm just reading or thinking or dreaming or coming up with ideas. And it may not look like I'm doing much, but that's where your brain is being allowed to be a kid again, to be creative, to be ingenuitive. And I think that that's one of our problems, is that, and that's actually a contributor to burnout, is that we aren't building time for our brains to kind of recalibrate and refresh and use our creative energies. And it creates a lack of joy. Because if you can build something, if you create something, if you can create a piece of art, write a great story, a great narrative, this is going to allow you to remind yourself that you're human and you get to tap into that human side again. So I've really found that that's an important discipline. It's not easy to do and it can get wrecked really easy. But if you can teach everybody around you, this is my green zone, this is my work zone, like don't put a meeting there, but then also respect it and make sure that you take that time. And the last thing is sometimes you got to take that time to just go blow off some steam. So sometimes that time will just get blown up. And instead of me coming in and doing my 9 to noon green zone work, I'm going to go out for a really long walk and just think, you know, and because I protected that time, maybe that's what I do. And I catch up with work later, you know, maybe that means I stay later that in the office that day. But I think like, as long as you're able to kind of buy back that time somehow, that's why I would say, figure out a way to buy your time, you know, carve out that time, protect that time, because time is everything. And if you can use that time to create, recalibrate, refresh, get energized, get excited, get back some joy in your day, in your week, like it's the best way to just be alive again, right? Be alive at work and be alive in your life.
I think that just listening to you talk is getting me, you know, excited about hitting the ground running on some of these days. And I kind of find very similar time with the green zone and now having kind of administrative time as well. It certainly helps to not be doing your main writing at like 11 p.m. at night or on like a, you know, a Saturday night after the kids are in bed or, you know, whatever, after you've done everything else and you're basically either going to pass out or like have to write this paper.
Yeah, you just resent the work then. Right. There's no joy in it because it's Saturday night and you're only doing it because it's the only other time you had. I write almost no papers on the weekends now. You know, I just will not do it. I can't do it. You know, that's time to be a human being, a dad, you know, other things. You know, it's very hard to actually get any of that work stuff done. But you have to make it a discipline at some point to do it.
We're kind of finishing up here, so I have a couple last questions. One is a little bit of switching gears, and I feel like I need to ask this because it's you and I. But do you have any predictions for the upcoming NFL season?
All I can tell you is the Chiefs had some of the best draft picks I've seen. Top the first four rounds, all defensive players. Loved it. And then Emmett Johnson. I mean, I'm from Nebraska, so I feel like I was opening presents on Christmas for the Chiefs, you know. So I think he was round five, you know, and I think he's a beast, one of the best rushers in the Big Ten. I think the Chiefs are looking dangerous, man. I'm sorry.
I saw the draft, and I hate to admit it, but it looked like they nailed it. And for those out there that don't know the history, but Dr. Sauer is a big Kansas City Chiefs fan, and I'm a big Buffalo Bills fan, and we've battled back and forth. One of us seems to come out on top a little bit more than the other, and eventually maybe that'll change. But it's been a fun way to spend more time together. That's for sure.
Yeah. We've been able to at least host Alex more than one occasion, as he's enjoyed sometimes a loss, sometimes a win.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that the wins are in the regular season and the losses are in the playoffs. And maybe we can just flip that script. But two last questions. First one is, is there anything that you could go back and tell your younger self, like a piece of advice?
Yeah, that's a pretty easy one. Slow down, which I know sounds like the opposite of everything I just told you, but I think for every yin, there's a yang. For every one side of the coin, there's another. And I think it's a double-edged sword, you know? And I think that I have been I've had a chip on my shoulder as a kid growing up, and, you know, I've always had something to prove. And I think it's just made me dive in head first over and over again. And I am not going to deny that that has benefited many aspects of my life. But if I was to do it all over again and tell myself some advice, I'd say, remember that you need to slow down, take a breath and look around and enjoy the moment. Don't let the moments pass you by. And I also think, I would say to myself, be kind to yourself so that you can also be kind to others along the way. Because I do think that when we are really critical of ourselves and when we get wrapped up in shame, what it does, and this is not me speaking, this is what the evidence teaches us, what shame does is it creates internal violence against our own brain. You know, and so this gets into sort of like attachment theory and all these things that I've learned about from therapists along the way. And you know, but the reality is when we grow up and we struggle with attachment, which I think was a struggle for me because I got moved around so much. And so that the good side of that was I developed a lot of resilience, but I also learned don't be attached to anything because your best friend is going to be gone next year. And you can't guarantee on what's going to be permanent. And I think as a result of that, you kind of pivot to one or two different directions. You either kind of go down the narcissism route, you know, where it's everything is about making yourself first in the center and like everyone else takes a back seat and kind of gets trampled along the way, or you go down the shame route. Either way, what I found is that the shame route leads to shutting down and the lack of vulnerability. And it turns out that vulnerability is the exact opposite of shame and allows you to overcome shame and allows you to actually build those connections that are what actually makes life good. It's the connections with people along the way that makes building a transplant program actually a good thing, right? It means nothing if there aren't people to benefit. People on the team, the patients that benefit, the society that benefits. It's the relationships, it's the connections to people. But you can't connect with people until you can overcome the need to be vulnerable. And so I would say, go ahead and put yourself out there. It's okay to lose. It's okay to fail. It's okay to have people disappoint you. Don't shut down the opportunity to continue to make yourself vulnerable to what may be coming down the pipeline, you know, what may be coming down the road. The best is yet to come. And I think that, you know, it's being able to get to know people across our field, people like you and people like our friends across the country. You know, these relationships can have a lifetime legacy impact. And it's about the connections that make life worth living. So I'd tell myself, slow down, have a little self-compassion, and stay vulnerable, because people want to hear what you really think. It turns out, this is what I believe. And by the way, if they don't want to hear what I really think, they don't have to be around me. That's fine. You know, learning that you can be okay knowing that someone doesn't want to hear what you think, they don't have to be your friend. That's fine. I'm not for everybody. That's okay. Learn that lesson. Move on.
I think that that's phenomenal advice, and I think that that's great advice for everybody. And I hope you know, people listening really appreciate that. The last thing, kind of like a fun little thing, is there anything that not a lot of people know about you that you'd be willing to share? Some, you know, little fun tidbit of information.
Oh man, I mean that's a tricky category, because it's that I don't want them that they don't know about me by design, right? Like,
right. Maybe just something that, you know, maybe from your youth or some, you know, hobby that you have that maybe we wouldn't think of, that you don't talk about a lot.
I mean, I think it's a pretty benign thing, so I guess I can share and not feel completely embarrassed. But there was a day where I could play the piano, the guitar, the drums, like a drum set, and all the forms of percussion, and sing. And I could, you know, I could play ball in all of those categories. I don't do any of this stuff anymore, as you know, otherwise you probably would have dragged me out. But there was a day.
This is news to me, and we might have to reassess letting you off the hook when a guitar comes out or if there's an opportunity to sing. So
yeah, so a little piece of trivia, just that you can look up as part of historical fact, that, you know, the Rochester, University of Rochester Med School, they always had a talent show. Did they still do this when you were a med student there?
They do.
So I performed. I played the piano and sang for Tiny Dancer, Elton John's Tiny Dancer. And I won the award for the talent show. And it was so good that the dean of the medical school invited my now wife at the time girlfriend, to come out and, you know, make a trip. And I did this performance again for some donors or something. I don't remember why, but he made me do it again. And he flew her out. He made a whole deal of it. So I was good enough to get the talent show award once upon a time.
That seems legit. You know, our mutual mentor and advisory dean in med school, Dr. David Lambert, I think that this was his last year in that role, this last match day. So I'll have to make sure he listens in on this, so, you know, we can corroborate that. But
Dick Lambert can corroborate this.
Oh, that's great. Well, I really appreciate your time. And I think that these insights have been incredible. As I've sat here and listened to it, I think that you should write a book about this, because it felt like reading a self-help book. You know, I know a lot of it has come from other books, but your perspective is so unique, and your experiences, everything that you've done, you know, certainly someone that I've looked up to over the years and continue to. And I'm just glad for our friendship and that we're able to meet via social media, sliding into the DMs and then meeting in person like years later. This was a phenomenal conversation. Thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. And I think that the one thing I just want to try to be that voice for is to just be bold, make no small plans. Whatever you want to do in life, think big. And go do it, dream big, and don't let someone tell you that, you know, you can't chase something. I think there's way too much fear motivating people these days, and especially in our profession. And our profession needs bold action, you know, whether it's to be bold and be the best parent, be, you know, that you can be, you know, be better than just me. There's so much mediocrity, and it's just be able to think about how you can make an impact, you know, wherever that space is, and really do your best. You know, it's the same things I try to teach my kids. Like, I don't care if you're the best, but I just want you to give it your best. And I think that, you know, challenge yourself, because the world really just needs us to lead. And that's, to me, the best way to lead is just to don't put yourself in a box, you know, get outside of it.
Well, that wraps things up. Dr. Sauer, thank you so much. This is exactly the kind of conversation this show exists to bring forward. For our listeners, You can find Moving the Needle in Medicine on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, through the HCP Live Cardiology platform, and on YouTube. Subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with someone who needs to hear it. We'll see you next month.